All right, so we're officially on the record. Okay, so good morning, Alex.
Good morning.
we're actually not, it's going to be written, but still.
Are you going to take notes from the recording?
Yes.
Okay, got it. All right, so I gotta be all
Yeah,
focused.
no, you don't, but I was just doing that to set the mood. So we're good, okay? Okay. So you were once a criminal defense attorney.
Correct.
Now you are the prosecutor for Orange County. What would you
Correct.
say? Right. What would you say is the difference in how you approach your cases from both sides?
As a prosecutor, I feel that I have a greater responsibility to lean forward a little bit in terms of what I think justice looks like. As prosecutors, we decide whether someone's going to be charged, whether a plea offer is going to be offered, and what that plea offer is going to be, and ultimately how a case is going to be resolved. Whereas as a defense attorney, I'm kind of at the whim of what the prosecutor decides, and I have to play defense. So
Literally.
as a prosecutor, I just feel like I'm in a better position to kind of shape what justice looks like.
Okay. So let's talk about George Zimmerman. What was your immediate reaction when you found out your student had essentially murdered somebody?
It was shocking, to feel that I was connected to such a impactful case in that way.
And this is before you found out you had to even testify, right?
So, this occurred around 2012. So at the time, I was about 2 years removed from being George Zimmerman's professor at Summerlin State College. And at the time, I was on active duty. And quite frankly, when the news hit, at least when it got to Maryland, the news report was kind of vague. Teenager shot in Florida. Then it was black teen shot in Central Florida. Then it was, Sanford, Seminole County. I'm like, whoa, that's the backyard. That's home. What's going on? And initially, there were names, but then I think later on in the week they started putting pictures to names. And at first, I didn't recognize the name, but when I saw the face, I'm like, I know this guy from somewhere. And I started calling
So
people
it
that
didn't
were in hospital.
immediately click.
No, it did not immediately click. It took a few days.
Okay.
And then one day, as I'm driving into work, I saw his name in my mind's eye on the class roster. And I remember I kept the email account for that particular class. And when I logged in and I searched his name, I saw all the emails between he and I, and the memories just started to become more vivid.
Okay.
But to answer your question directly, it was shock. It was shocking.
Well, how was he as a student? Like, was he smart? And then, like, as a black man, how do you feel like he respected your authority in particular, especially since you guys are kind of like, even though you were technically his teacher, you were pretty much around the same age?
Correct. So, again, I taught at Summerlin State College. It was an evening program. It was in the criminal justice kind of career track, and it was a mixed crowd. You had folks who were, I want to say, your more traditional age, so maybe right out of high school, or 20. You had folks that were doing criminal justice maybe as a second career, so maybe they were in their, late 30s, early 40s.
'Cause he was in
And
his late 20s at the time.
he was around his mid to 20s at the time. And in terms
Wait,
of
I'm
very
losing you for a second.
respect,
Say that again.
I said in terms of respect, I mean, he was very respectful. But the one thing that did catch me as different was, I taught my this was an undergraduate course, but granted, I had just come out of law school, so I taught this course the way a law school course was taught, which is like the Socratic method. And I would pose different hypotheticals that, focus on a particular learning objective. And most of these hypotheticals dealt with interactions with law enforcement? What do you do when you're in a traffic stop? How would an officer react? How should you should react? And I noticed that most of the students would have questions about, or questions from the perspective as if they were stopped, right? How should they react to law enforcement? He, on the other hand, would ask questions from the perspective as if he was the law enforcement officer, right? Mm. How he someone, how to make an arrest, how to, you know, what he would need to do in order to search a vehicle, you know, how to establish probable cause, which, you know, for, you know, the average 25, 26-year-old, most of them aren't thinking like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that as, you know, unique about him. But then, you know, knowing his story and how everything is wrapped together after the fact, you know, it all kind of made sense.
Because essentially you were testifying in the case. You were testifying that you taught him the Stand Your Ground law, right?
Well, yeah. So the thing was whether he was in class that day. So, I mean, that we went over Stand Your Ground, so we couldn't specifically know that. But what he either knew or should have known about Florida Stand Your Ground law and just the legal theory of self-defense in general.
Okay, so do you feel like, in terms of Stand Your Ground, that it only benefits certain demographics? Because it's not standard, it's like some states have Stand Your Ground law, some states don't. But do you feel, as a general statement, that it benefits mostly white-ish men?
I think as it's applied, right? I think if you look at, you know, you have what's called in our profession law on the books and law in action.
Okay.
When you look at a statute, right, you don't really see the racial disparity in the statute. But then when you look how it's applied, and a lot of this application deals with the social context, right? You're going to have a lot more, you know, police encounters and certain, you know, densely populated areas, which generally tend to be lower socioeconomic class, which generally tend to be Black. So you're going to have more arrests, more action in these areas, and then these certain laws begin to have a racial impact. So with Stand Your Ground, yes, statistically, it is a proven fact that when it as applied to someone who is Caucasian, if you will, they generally receive the benefit of the Stand Your Ground law, meaning like they're not going to get arrested on the scene. You know, they're going to be able to go home, you know, after a shooting where the cops on the scene make an assessment that the person was justified in the shooting, was acting in self-defense.
What was your grade? I mean, what was his grade in your class?
I think he got an A.
Mm,
yeah,
okay.
He was a bright student, you know, very inquisitive. You know, you can tell he wasn't just taking the class to be taking the class. You know, he put some effort into it.
Do you think the way that the case was built and, I guess, presented, do you think on the legal side versus the court of public opinion, do you think that the verdict was correct? That's a tough question, I know. Yeah,
that's a very tough question.
I'm hard-hitting journalism over here.
Yeah. I think from the legal side, it's a very hard question because what it essentially boils down to is self-defense and what it means and how it's applied. And, you know, you can look up the jury instruction.
Mm-hmm.
So the jury instruction has Stand Your Ground built into it, right? So you have a specific statute that is the Stand Your Ground statute. But then even if we're not talking about Stand Your Ground per se, because again, the big misconception is that there was an actual Stand Your Ground hearing in this case and there wasn't.
Okay.
The jury instructions, as it pertains to self-defense in the state of Florida, has that Stand Your Ground mechanism in place, meaning that if you're confronted with a force that you believe can cause you serious bodily injury or death, you can counter that force with deadly force. And in this case, I think the facts that the defense tried to focus the jury on was, one, George Zimmerman at some point in time was on his back. And we know that because of the trajectory of the bullet entering Trayvon Martin. And we also know that, or, you know, strongly assume that because of the gashes and lacerations that were on the back of George Zimmerman's head. Although those injuries were not life-threatening, the question is, if you're on your back, and as the defense portrayed it, someone was on top of you and putting your head into concrete, would you feel like your life was in danger or at least serious bodily injury? And if your answer to that question is yes, then you're authorized to use deadly force. And that's just a straight legal analysis of it. But then when we look at it from a social context, you look at it, well, was George Zimmerman following him anyway?
Right.
Didn't the officers tell him not to? You know, didn't it seem racially motivated because he said on the phone call to police, they always get away, or words to that effect? Who was he talking about? You know, he was armed and Trayvon Martin wasn't armed. He was a grown man. Trayvon Martin was a teen. So when you look at it from a...
And there was a weight discrepancy as well.
And yes. So all of that. So when you look at all of that, then, you know, you lie on the side of, you know, this was not fair. This was not justice, right?
Because so could it be argued that Trayvon Martin was essentially defending himself?
Right. So just the same way, if someone's attacking me, I'm gonna have the right to defend myself. And, you know, you can definitely make that argument. But unfortunately, Trayvon Martin didn't survive that encounter to make that argument. So we will never know his side or version of events.
If you were on the jury, what would your verdict have been? Like, what would your, would you have? Ooh, yeah. Hard hitting. Pow.
I really don't know. Because
That's fair. Yeah.
You gotta think about it. You know, when we watch things on TV or read things in a book, you know, you have more of a time to contemplate it.
Okay.
More of a time to read it and perceive it. Whereas you gotta think, these people were in a jury trial for what, well over a week? So who knows?
What is generally the standard in terms of murder trials, in terms of how long they generally last?
It varies. There is no standard, right? What I think about it is, these are folks who have jobs, who have lives, who have kids. Who knows what they're paying attention to, right? Mm. So you may watch something on TV and you may be like, aha, that's my reason to vote guilty. That's my reason to vote not guilty. And that particular juror just missed it, right? It went over their head because they were thinking about what they're going to eat for lunch, right? So it's hard to kind of say how I would vote. But what I can say is that from a legal perspective, I can see how a jury voted to acquit him.
Okay. So George Zimmerman and, say, like, for instance, Kyle Rittenhouse, which in some ways they're very similar cases. Do you feel like them being found not guilty has emboldened not only them, but other people who could say that they want to take the law into their own hands and who are, you know, essentially these young white men who feel like they have to be authority over black people in particular, or just in the world?
Yeah, I think so. I think those are the examples or the modern manifestations of that sentiment, of the belief that, you know, we need to take law into our own hands. And if you do any study about our history, you would realize that, you know, just like, you know, we in earlier colonial times, we didn't really have too much of a standing army. Mm-hmm. We relied on militia, right? Mm-hmm. Farmers, mm-hmm. ranchers, and stuff like that. And the same thing with our early police force. I mean, there was a sheriff, but they didn't have money to have a whole squadron of deputy sheriff. It was, you know, Frank the Butcher, who cut meat and also
cut people.
They cut people, right? So I think that sentiment has passed down, and for a lot of minorities, we don't have that. That was never our history, right? We were never relied on to be protectors of our community and things of that nature. We were always at the whim of what society told us was justice and right.
Well, and so, I think, yeah, even just white male privilege as a general statement has been a global sentiment. And with integration over time and Black people and different races having new positions of power. I mean, you're one of the prosecutors. How many prosecutors are there for Orange County, by the way?
At least between Orange and Osceola counties, which encompass the Ninth Circuit, at least 100.
Okay. So, yeah. But, right. But you're in a position essentially of power.
Correct.
Where, you know, even to the point where we can say you can make a decision that may change a white man's life forever. So I think, you know, there is something to be said for they feel like they're losing their power and possibly entering law enforcement or acting as law enforcement is a way for them to continue to assert their power and hold on to their perceived authority. Just, you know, by birthright.
I would say that. And I wish that, I don't want to take that away from anyone to a certain extent. I mean, I think that we have trained law enforcement professionals, and if you see something, you should say something. You should always enter into your hands unless it's an emergency, right? If you're in a place and you see someone shooting, then, you know, if you're capable, willing, and able, go ahead and step in. But I would wish that people in Black and brown communities acted more like stakeholders in their community. And when they did see stuff, they reported. I think they just, we have a sentiment of, when I say we, I'm speaking from a Black and brown perspective, that, you know, if something happens, if it doesn't happen to me and mine, it ain't my business. And until we can collectively govern ourselves and be the checks and balances of ourselves to a certain degree. Obviously, again, you don't want to be taking law into your own hands per se, but until we can provide that some sort of sense of self-governance, we're always going to be at the whim of what, you know, the so-called white patriarchy wants for us.
So most people don't know that Trayvon Martin's murder and Casey Anthony's murdering? The Casey Anthony case, they're actually, 30, 40 minutes from each other. Like, obviously, if you're from the area, you know that. But, so you currently work as the prosecutor for that county. What would you have done differently? I don't know if you were able to necessarily watch the case, you know, day by day, but what would you say you would have done differently in that case?
In the Casey Anthony trial?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Trayvon Martin trial?
You said what?
In the Casey Anthony trial or the Trayvon Martin trial?
Actually, both. Both, since we're here.
Okay. Well, the Trayvon Martin trial, I think I would have, I don't want to call it witness preparation, because that is a taboo word. You don't want to make it that the prosecution is influencing what someone's going to testify about, but definitely help them shake their expectations and be able to be prepared for how they're going to be treated on the stand. You know, Trayvon Martin's friend, Rachel Gentile, I think was the only person that was able to kind of recount those moments right before he died. And, you know, this young woman isn't used to these types of settings, being on trial, being questioned. And the public eye, you know, she doesn't use the same vernacular that, you know, someone with perhaps a law degree or a professional capacity would use. So I think a lot, you know, the prosecution missed an opportunity to tell Trayvon Martin's story to Rachel Gentile. And if you know, this was the young girl who
was on the phone with him.
By the media's criticism, came across as, you know, confrontational, someone that had a bad attitude.
Almost angry black woman. Angry, uneducated exactly. Black woman.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So to the extent they could have helped her with this very critical moment in her life and in this case, I think that could have possibly been something to... It's a low-hanging fruit. I mean, it's one of those things that I think it had the most immediate ability to control. From my perspective, you know, I don't know how much contact they had with her. I don't know how willing she was to have contact with the state prior to trial. Who knows? But she did not have the effect that I think the state wanted and intended to have.
Okay.
And she was their key witness. What? As far as Casey Anthony is concerned, I mean, I wasn't following the intimate details of that case, obviously, as much as I was, you know, Trayvon Martin case. But from what I do recall, there wasn't really much that you could do. I think jurors are human beings, and a lot of times, humans, we make our decisions are influenced not just based on the facts, but how we feel about certain situations. And I think, you know, given Casey Anthony's age, her appearance, there was that sentiment that she couldn't have done something like this.
Mm.
You know, this mm-hmm. this young, you know, white who kind of, you know, just fit the role of young and naive, if you will, couldn't be so diabolical in bringing about, you know, the death of her daughter.
So I have a theory about what happened, but I didn't watch the documentary. But what would you say, did you your sentiment about the situation change after watching the documentary?
I didn't watch the documentary. But I think that, you know, she was just a mom who liked to party.
Right.
And I don't know if she was in the midst of partying or what happened, but maybe, you know, she was trying to put her daughter to sleep. You know, maybe her daughter was just being tough to handle at the moment. And she kind of gave her, so I forgot what the substance was. But
I think it was, did she use chloroform? Or no?
Yeah, I think it was chloroform.
Yeah. Which is a common way to knock people out. And I think it maybe just...
It was a lethal dose. It was an unintentional lethal dose.
Which is still a very wild way to make your kid go to sleep.
Really
if we're,
wild, right?
You know,
really
I mean...
You could give us some NyQuil.
Yeah, I would say that's, you know, and then some people even roll their eye at that. But, you know, chloroform, you know, you're passing out. Like, that's...
Yeah.
Okay. So what was, okay, so back to Trayvon Martin case, though, but what was your reaction when you found out that you would have to testify? Because that's a totally different, you know, thing. Like, what was your, because I remember where you were the day before eating mac and cheese. That's off the record. That's off the record.
Okay. I wasn't terribly shocked. I knew at the very minimum, just based on my legal training, that they at least would want to have talked to me, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just, you know, when something like this happens, you know, the state does an extensive background check on the victim, on the defendant. They want to know where they went to school, what they were into, yada, yada, yada. So I want to say it was maybe about 6 months or so, perhaps, maybe less than that, after the shooting, that I got a phone call from the chair of the legal department at Summit State College. I said, hey, we have some investigators here. They want a copy of the syllabus that you use for your class and potentially, you know, provide your contact number if they have any follow-up questions. And I, you know, I gave it. And it was a few months after that that I actually, you know, spoke to an investigator, and, you know, they wanted to know about my assignments and what I remembered. And I had actually had some, you know, emails and homework assignments from Mr. Zimmerman and that I was able to provide. But the fact that they wanted to call me in to testify, I was just quite unsure. So I think what it really kind of boiled down to was that George Zimmerman, outside of the trial, before the trial, had made some statements to the media that he's just your average Joe, right? Knew nothing about self-defense as a potential. He wasn't as calculated and sophisticated as the state wanted people to believe in terms of he knew how to shoot somebody and get away with it. And I think that was the, you know, because he had, I think his uncle or grandfather was a judge or some, so he had some connection to the legal community in some regard. And the fact that, you know, he was pursuing a career in criminal justice, you know, the talking points, the talking line was that he was this person that knew how to get out of things.
Mm-hmm.
So he went on, I forgot what show it was, with his attorney, and, you know, made the presentation that he didn't. Like, you know, he's just like everyone else or whatever the case is. So I think the state brought me on to rebut that sentiment. However, I think in doing so, I think the defense saw an opportunity to kind of delve into what self-defense means or what it could look like. And from their perspective, self-defense looked like, well, yeah, you may think that George Zimmerman was the initial aggressor, but things can happen during an exchange where the initial aggressor is now the victim.
Mm.
And the victim now is not necessarily acting in self-defense per se, but they're going above and beyond self-defense to the point where now the original aggressor is a potential victim and authorized to use deadly force.
Do you agree with that?
I agree with that legal construct. I don't necessarily agree with that in this specific set of facts and circumstances.
Okay.
But I do believe in that. You know, if I have an issue with someone and I start a fight and I'm punching them, and then that person gets the best of me and knocks me to the ground and goes and picks up a 2x4 and starts beating me over the head repeatedly,
that's different.
You know, but I mean, right. So that's a set of facts and circumstances where I can say that, you know, that legal construct would apply and I would be justified in using deadly force. I can't necessarily say that in a Trayvon Martin case. I don't know what happened.
How did your life change during and after the trial? I know that the ladies were very excited, but besides that, carte blanche, what would you say, like, was some of the interesting things during and after the trial that changed your life in particular?
Yeah, well, I got a first-hand experience on how, like, people just jump on a situation and kind of go crazy, if you will. Like, I had over 18,000 emails.
Jesus!
In like 24 or 48 hours, right?
Like that. What were the emails? Because look, I was even in the comments defending you. I just want you to know that. And I was literally to tell somebody, you're talking shit, but he literally went to the same high school as you. So I don't know what we're doing here. But that's beside the point. I've been blocked that person. But
what? Full range. So you had compliments, you did a great job, da, 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 da. You had criticisms, you humanized George Zimmerman too much, or
mm-hmm.
you were a state witness, but you came across as a defense witness. there were people trying to propose marriage. There were fathers trying to marry off their daughters. The full range. The full range of whatever you can think occurred. But, you know, it, especially in the legal community, I mean, people recognize you from the trial. And there's always that, you know, that curiosity. So the question comes up a lot. But then also there's that responsibility, right, to have been in that case and be so well-versed in, you know, stand your ground law, imperfect self-defense. You know, when I got off of active duty and returned home to Central Florida, I kind of made it a point to go out in the community and, you know, teach youth about police interactions, use of force. You know, right now, as my role as a prosecutor, one of the case, the set of cases that I handle deal with officers and use of force. So whenever there's a allegation or incident where an officer has had to use force, whether it be physical force with, you know, a battery or hitting someone, striking someone, or a shooting case, I help to evaluate that case and make a decision whether that officer should be charged. So I think, you know, that that experience, at least to me, came with the responsibility to do more. You know, there's that adage, and I'm at a loss for words, maybe you can help me out, but, you know, to whom much is given, much is expected, or much is required.
Yeah, I got you. Yeah.
So I didn't just take that experience in a vacuum, like, oh, you know, I testified. I was like, you know, I'm not the type to want to profit from it in any financial way. You know, there was people who wanted me to write a book or give me, you know, tell my story and pay me for it. And I, you know, just that didn't feel right.
Mm-hmm.
But my way of giving back was to kind of be that advocate, kind of be that teacher. I was actually able to connect with Trayvon Martin's mom, who, mm-hmm, I don't know if you knew, but ran for office down in Miami Gardens, I believe. And, you know, her and I, you know, keep in touch from time to time. And she herself is not taking this situation that happened to her son as just something that, you know, was a tragic incident that happened in her life, in her son's life, but as an opportunity to kind of give back and tell her story, tell her son's story, and just kind of raise a level of consciousness in the world about, you know, interactions within, you know, the Black and brown communities, particularly as it relates to, you know, law enforcement and citizen interactions.
So because you ran for state senate, would you run again?
Would I? I mean, sure. Am I? Is that where my focus is? Not at this time.
Okay, where's your focus?
Drinking enough water, eating enough vitamins, getting enough sleep.
Okay.
You know, my focus is on the work. Whether that means I'm an elected official, whether that means I'm a lawyer, whether it means, you know, I volunteer, it really doesn't matter too much. You know, the whole political thing, I feel like as a society, we become way too polarized. And if you don't present yourself as a candidate who's from the far left or the far right, it's really hard to kind of find that lane to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of like one of the biggest deterrences, because I don't necessarily want to have to wave the flag of any particular party. I have an independent mind, independent thought. Mm-hmm. There's things that I feel conservative about, there's things I feel liberal about, and I don't want to have to feel beholden to any one party, but perhaps a nonpartisan race, you know, but we'll see.
So I'm going to wrap up the questions in a second, but as a prosecutor for, you know, basically Orlando and Osceola County, what are your aspirations? I mean, what are some of the ways that you feel like you're going to help correct some of the injustices in the justice system? And, well, I should say, do you even agree that there are injustices in the justice system? And if so, what are your, you know, some of the ways that you go about correcting some of those things?
So I'm kind of like an OG in the prosecutorial or the criminal law field, if you will. You know, I've been practicing now for over 10 years. I'm no longer considered a young lawyer. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, in addition to handling cases on my own, I think my biggest influence and my biggest opportunity to have an impact is to train the young minds of lawyers that are coming into the field and law students. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I taught as an adjunct, you know, for a few years at Florida A&M College of Law.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of the reasons why I decided to close my practice and take on this position as a prosecutor for less pay, right? Something good money, but I wasn't really influencing the people. Right.
Mm-hmm.
I help my clients with their cases, and that's about as far as the influence went. But, you know, in this prosecutor role, you know, I can be more of a mentor and kind of shape the minds of what I think a prosecutor should have.
What's harder, being a lawyer or being in Afghanistan?
Being a lawyer. In Afghanistan, you got a whole team, mm-hmm. right? You guys are trained. You know what your enemy is. You know how to, get rid of the target. But as a lawyer, there's so many landmines, if you will, so many issues you got to think of and prepare for. And especially if you're in private practice, you don't necessarily have that team behind you. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of gotta rely on informal relationships with other colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
You know, informal relationships with other mentors to kind of help, you know, guide you through that career. So.
Okay. So last question. This is a doozy. But actually, I got two. I'm sorry. As a lawyer, as a black man. Especially as a prosecutor, have you been stopped by the police?
As a lawyer, yeah, I have.
Since being a prosecutor, and then
since being a prosecutor, no.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. Have those? I'm assuming those have been pleasant stops ish.
Yeah. You know, usually I'm speeding and.
Okay, well, I'm gonna strike that from the.
I still have that anxiety though.
Okay.
I'm not sure, you know, how that interaction is gonna turn out. I'm very conscious of, you know, where I have my hands, you know, asking for permission to, you know, get my license and registration. So it's still a very
tense, anxious filled moment for sure.
Yeah, and it's humbling. You know, I see certain things that are portrayed, whether it be in art through movies or in real life through, you know, news footage of how some people act with police. And it's like, why are you stopping me? How dare you? You know, getting yeah. real, you know, and I go well above and beyond to like.
I'm assuming these stops were in the. I'm assuming these stops were in the Altima, not the Volkswagen.
Yeah.
Sir, are you driving your baby mama's car? Like, yeah, the Altima is a. Okay, so last question is a doozy, Alex. Are you ready?
All right.
How do you feel about the argument for defund the police?
So that tagline is very shocking to the consciousness. And I think it has to be to a certain extent.
Okay.
Because if you made it any logical or sensical or try to describe it, then it wouldn't have the effect that it needs to have. It wouldn't spark the conversation, if you will.
Okay.
And it kind of goes back to why I think politics is so polarized, is because if you're not polarized, you're not getting anyone's attention.
Okay.
So what I think is, I don't think you should, you know, on the extreme end, I don't think you should get rid of police, right? I don't think you should take money away from them per se. But what I think you, what needs to be done is, like, you really need to look at how resources are allocated in a law enforcement community and in a municipality as a whole. You know, do we have enough mental health people trained in mental health that are able to respond to certain calls? That's one of the, I would say, the good things that, you know, the local police department is taking a step up and doing initiatives, is trying to increase the number and equip, you know, when they're going to like a home where there's been a report of a disturbance, right? Instead of addressing that with a strict law enforcement force, they're accompanied by someone who's trained in mental health, right? To kind of de-escalate, if you will, that situation. You also got to look at, you know, especially in some of these more rural counties, is how is it that you have your law enforcement agency that basically look like the army, right? They got the same outfits, they got the same tanks, they got the same weaponry, but y'all don't have body cams? You know what I mean? So, like, where are you? And Polk County, and you can put me on the record, is one of those counties where, you know, the sheriff is categorically against body cam, right? So you really kind of have to take a look at where are we putting our money into.
And Polk County, is extremely rural, but it's also a lot of poor Black and white people.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a lot of poor Black people in Polk County. A lot.
Yes.
Well, this was great, Alex. We're off the record. Let me put it on pause.